Alan, talked to you last night for quite a while. Anything interesting food related happened to you today?
Food wise, I ate mostly leftovers, but for supper we got takeaway from a Greek restaurant.
Oh, nice.
So I guess the answer is no.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with Alan Sutterby.
Hello.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So let's kick it off. So, Alan, we have two topics for the show today.
Yeah. I want to do yours first. Can we do yours first?
Okay, sure.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one.
Okay, great. I hope you have something to start off with for it, because I've been meaning to think about it all week, and I feel like I haven't had time to do that, so this will be fun. So my topic is, to put it simply, does having an opinion about everything food related make you a food snob?
Right.
So I feel like, because I spend so much time around food and preparing food and thinking about food for work and enjoying food, I have to, a lot of the time, sort of like limit the amount of opinion or of my own opinion that I inject into like decisions that I make about food.
Right.
But I definitely have an opinion about just about everything food related.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm just curious as to whether you think that makes me a food snob. And then I'm also curious to find out if you feel like you also have an opinion about everything food related, mm-hmm. and whether like, you know, generally you feel like a food snob, or if maybe just like sometimes you feel like a food snob in
right.
like certain situations or whatever. I'm
okay.
super curious to find out.
So I think that you actually struck at the heart of the issue for me just by the way you introduced the topic. So the way I see it, having an opinion about everything food related does not make you a food snob. It comes down to how and when you choose to voice that opinion.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It's actually, you know what, it's kind of like politics. Like, you can have an opinion about everything under the sun, but it's not always appropriate to share it at the dinner table. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to have dinner with someone who just wants to talk about politics or religion or whatever, right?
Right. You mean family politics.
Well,
yeah.
So yeah. Like, it's okay to have the opinion, but there's a time and a place for all of that, right?
Right.
And maybe like a meal that's, you know, prepared honestly and humbly by a friend or family member, it doesn't really matter what you think about the technique or what the ingredients or whatever. Like, I think that well-rounded, mature, well-adjusted people will appreciate that meal for what it is and not try to put a fine point on some esoteric matter that their host or fellow diners don't care about, right?
Absolutely.
So it's great to have the opinion as a culinary professional or someone who, yeah, works in food and has to train people at a professional food service business. But yeah, like I said, a time and a place, right? Does that?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Okay. So I think that's largely how I feel about it as well, but follow me here.
Okay.
And I think that there are a lot of contexts that we can kind of like look at to sort of like try and maybe like analyze what is and isn't appropriate. Like, you know,
right.
But so like in this context where maybe you're having a meal at a friend's place or at a family member's house or it's a holiday celebration or something. So in that situation, you know, having the other people who may be there know that you work in a restaurant or that you're a chef or that you know a lot about food, it's sort of somewhat inevitable in that situation that they're going to solicit your opinion,
mm-hmm. right?
About you know, the food that they're serving or what you think about it, mm-hmm. and so like, you know, you kind of have to ride a line between and like I find often when I'm in that type of situation, when people do solicit my opinion, they ask me to be honest with them. Right. Yeah. And so sometimes I feel really conflicted because like I know that like I have a thick skin about the food that I prepare.
Right.
But I know that that's not the case for most people. You know, even working in a kitchen, you know, a lot of people are pretty thin-skinned about their ideas or the food that they prepare or whatever.
Yeah.
And so how do you then how do you provide like feedback honestly and not come off as a food snob?
I think
the way you put it like seems really easy. You just like appreciate the meal and everybody's yeah. happy and everyone enjoys it and you don't and you feel grateful because someone prepared food for you, and right. that's always like a very special thing. Like I know as a cook, when someone else prepares food for me, like I'm always super appreciative, like regardless of what my opinion of the quality might be or the you know, technique or whatever. But
yeah.
you know, when someone actually solicits your honest opinion, like how do you not come off as a food snob in that situation?
Okay. Something that maybe you're hinting at, like a lot of people, including ridiculously my own mother, a lot of people feel intimidated preparing food for a professional chef because they anticipate that they are food snobs and that they're silently judging everything that's been put in front of them. And I'll go on record saying that that's almost never the case, especially in terms of, you know, what you're making and the ingredients you're using. Like it's so ridiculous that my mother sometimes mentions that like, oh, I know it's not very much for a professional chef or whatever, but like, obviously she makes some of my favorite dishes in the entire world, and they're not haute cuisine or whatever, but her mac and cheese and her, you know, like whatever, roast chicken, whatever it is, like, it's simple and I grew up with it, and it's like, they're all showstoppers to me.
Right.
A lot of people they think that because you're a professional chef that you only like fancy ingredients, but like if I went to your house and you made hot dogs, I would be thrilled. Like hot dogs are in my top five favorite foods of all time. Like if you serve me Harvest brand hot dogs on white buns with French's mustard, like what more could I possibly want?
Yeah,
for real. Anyway, sorry, that was not really directing your question. So the thing is that very rarely in like a social gathering, I think very rarely are you actually asked for input or criticism on the food. Do you know what I mean? Like not very many people are going to ask, in my experience, like what do you really think of this meal? are you really put on the spot like that by people?
Okay. No, that's fair. I think that like, maybe like not put on the spot so much, like not in that way, like tell me what you think about it. But you know, like I think that, yeah, like there's an expectation that, you know, you will say something about it or whatever. And yeah, like I said, and this is what I usually tell people if I find that I'm in that situation where, you know, maybe I'm sensing that people are intimidated to cook for me or put food in front of me or something, like, yeah, what I usually tell people, which is basically what you just said, which is what I truly feel, is that like, it's not about the quality of the food. It's about the idea that someone took the time to prepare food
when
for you.
And when they ask you what you think of the food, that's what you say to them?
No. Okay. Like, yeah. No.
Like if they were like, what do you think about this meal that I made? And you're like, it's not important what I think about the food. It's more just that you prepared it.
No. I don't know. Maybe this is bad, and maybe I'm just like, maybe I just have no like social awareness. But if people solicit feedback about their food from me, I usually try to give them honest feedback. If there are like things that I think that, like, if they're actually asking, and I feel like, you know, they're asking because they're interested in my input because they feel like it might help them improve their cooking or something.
Yeah.
Like I usually will maybe try to say something analytical about the food, you know, like, because that's a lot of how, you know, like in my professional life, it's a lot of my thinking about food. I mean, obviously, like the genesis for like food ideas and wanting to do the work and stuff like that comes from passion. But a lot of the, you know, a lot of the decisions about, you know, like how to, like what techniques to use and how to logistically prepare meals, all that is like analytical thinking. And so I usually, like in the hot dog example, I don't know if there's anything I can provide. I try to pick something that isn't, well, also if it's delicious food, I'll honestly, you know, tell them that it's great and I wouldn't change anything, you know,
like, right. Yeah.
But you know, like if they're concerned about something, then, you know, like I'll let them know whether I feel like it's an issue or not. Or like if, you know, if they are self-conscious about how they prepared it or something, like I'll, you know, offer, like technique tips on technique or something, or like, you know, a way to make preparing the meal easier or something like that. I don't know.
I think that actually is an important point. Like if the person who prepared the meal not just asks you in a kind of vague way, like, what did you think? If they notice something, they're like, oh, like the pie crust is actually kind of soggy. Maybe then it's appropriate to be like, oh, well, like, how was it made? And like, what temperature was it baked at and stuff like that. Like, I think that's an appropriate time to, like, if they've noticed something or like have some kind of misgiving about what they've made, that's an interesting time to jump in. But like, very rarely would I, like, if someone said, what do you think of the meal? Like, hone in on something that I didn't like. And it really is rare, like, especially for family like it's Thanksgiving, it's Christmas, and there's like a spread, like there's going to be good stuff and there's going to be bad stuff. And like, I'll always expect, like, at a Thanksgiving meal, whatever house I'm in, I'm going to expect the turkey to be dry, the stuffing to be great, the pie filling to be okay, but the pastry to be soft. I don't know. It's always, maybe that just reveals more.
Maybe
about,
you are a food snob. Well,
but like, it's still all very, it's nourishing and it's gratifying and I still eat it and it's fine.
Yeah, totally.
But I would definitely never jump on one of those things. If asked in a broad way, what I thought of.
Right. Yeah. I guess like, I'm like, if someone asked me if their turkey was dry, and it was dry, I probably wouldn't tell them that it wasn't.
You're cold.
Isn't that like, aren't we trying to solve a problem though? Aren't they asking because they want to, I don't know. Yeah, maybe I am cold.
Like I don't know. Do you think, I think for me, like I think I'm a pragmatic person. And so I think about the kind of like, risk reward. Like if I live my entire life and every time I eat turkey, I tell the person who cooked it whether it was moist or dry, am I actually making the world a better place? Like, how constructive is it to tell everyone that their turkey is dry?
Yeah, totally.
Are they really going to make it better next time? And is that going to make the world a better place? Or am I just going to have a bunch of super awkward dinners with my in-laws? Or
yeah, I totally hear you. And I would never do that unsolicited, but for someone who's concerned that their turkey's dry and they're asking a professional whether they also share that opinion, you know, and if, for instance, they've never considered brining a turkey before, maybe you can change their turkey life.
Yeah, that's true. And for the record, like most people outside of the industry don't understand what makes meat dry. Like they don't understand right. that so much of the time it's just a matter, it's the simple matter of finishing temperature.
Yeah.
For like turkey breast.
Yeah. Or also for a roast or something like that.
Yeah. And they like, it's intuitive that, oh, well, like I cooked it, you know, with jus or with like, it was in moist heat or ever. So the meat should be,
yeah,
moist.
Oh, that's not really like 150 times.
Yeah, exactly. So, that has nothing to do with it really. And so in a professional setting and certainly in a, like a culinary instruction setting, I would always point it out and always talk about it. But even then, I feel like you need, people have to be, for it to really be effective, people have to be receptive to it and have to kind of have already acknowledged that the turkey is dry, if that makes sense.
Right,
like
yeah,
not totally. Necessarily. I think that this is something that has changed about the way that I operate in kitchens over the last 10 years. It's rarely effective to just kind of like storm through a kitchen pointing out what's wrong and how you would fix it. Mm-hmm. Like there needs to be the people you're working with or the people you're teaching have to be part of that process and have to already, like I said, kind of express the misgiving or understood the mistake or recognize the mistake for you to be able to correct it for them. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you can't just tell somebody what's wrong with something and expect that they're going to, even if you tell them what the solution is, unless they understand why the solution, or at least this is how it is for me, probably made me a horrible student, but like, unless I can intuitively understand the reason why, you know, making a change is going to affect the product in the end. Like I can't internalize that, then it doesn't really, you know, it's not going to help me to be able to like consistently do it better. You know?
Yeah. And that's a big thing. So actually one of my mentors, at Nate at the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology would always talk about his name is Chef Wong, Ron Wong.
Does he still work there?
Yeah, like I actually worked with him this fall.
Oh, cool.
Like instructed with him. And like he's been at Nate literally for 30 years. And so he's very much, we've got our textbook, we've got the kind of specs from Alberta Industry and Training, and he knows them inside out and backwards because he's been teaching them for 30 years. So he knows those kind of classical techniques. But in terms, like as a teacher, he's always trying to emphasize the why, because like you said, that's how the students really internalize it and take it with them. So something as simple as like this week at school, a student was slicing green onions and he sliced all of the green parts of the green onion. And then he took the last like 3 inches of white part and just threw it in the garbage. And so I ran over.
Gross.
Ran over. And like, it's not enough to say like, no, we use the whole onion, idiot, and then walk away. Mm-hmm. Like we take the next onion and like I asked him why he threw them out and he said because the white part is fibrous and bitter. And I said okay, well, let's take another onion and we'll slice a bit of the green part and slice a bit of the white part and we're going to taste them side by side. And like there's no, I don't care if you're like a master sommelier, like there's not really a difference between the taste. For our purposes, then this was like for a short order cafeteria, basically there's no appreciable difference between the flavor of the white and the green. Like it's certainly not, there's no grounds to describe the white as fibrous and bitter.
And bitter. Yeah. That's just like something made up that somebody probably told him at some point.
Exactly. Yeah. A food snob presumably told him that.
and but, turned him into a junior food snob.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's a horrible disease, so, Alan.
I know that, like, and actually, especially in Chinese cooking, I know they do make the distinction between the two parts. And like, I've had one Chinese cook tell me like the greens are whatever for say onion cakes and the whites are for wontons like or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But like we're talking about sliced onions on a dish in a short order cafeteria and there's really no grounds to throw out half of the or a third of the onion and there's no grounds for describing the white as fibrous, I think. Anyways, stopping, tasting, talking about what our end purpose is, like that's a much more, I think that was more effective, hopefully, than just embarrassing him or...
Yeah, or just enlisting your own opinion as what should be the...
Right,
as what he should follow going forward. Like, yeah. What's to differentiate the opinion that you just gave him from the opinion that someone else told him that the white is fibrous and bitter or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I suppose it's possible that he came to that opinion on his own through his own experience, but more likely it sounds to me like that's, you know, something that he heard somewhere in a kitchen that he was in or something.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, Alan. Lightning round. Okay, we're no longer at the family dinner table where someone has prepared a meal for you. Mm-hmm. Let's try finding some different food opinion circumstances.
Okay.
So you go out to eat with another person. So somebody else in the rest, like a cook in a restaurant, is preparing the food for you,
mm-hmm.
and then it's brought out to you. So you have no connection to the person who prepared it.
Okay.
How does sharing your food opinion fit in that situation?
Sorry, dining out. I don't know the kitchen.
Well, yeah, I know that seems unlikely, but.
And you mean sharing the opinion with my...
With your co-diners.
Oh, yeah. If, again, like it's, you have to, and maybe this is rare in kitchen culture, but you have to have some kind of emotional intelligence about whether or not your dining companions are interested. Like there's people, like if you and I went out for dinner, like obviously
all we would do is analyze the food and talk about it.
Yeah. And that would be fun and I would be happy to do it. But like if I were, I don't even know what, like if I were catching up with an old friend who's not particularly interested in food, like obviously I wouldn't hit them over the head with, or like I would put them through an analysis of, you know, the wine pairings or something if I didn't think they were interested. I think where it really becomes interesting though is where do you, if you're dissatisfied with something, where's the line where you tell the staff or like,
right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question.
Like how often in your life, actually I'm trying to think now from like having eaten out with you, if I've ever seen it. Have you ever like sent something back?
Yeah, I definitely have sent food back before. I try to be a very accommodating customer because I work in the industry and I, you know, understand what it can be like. But I've definitely received food in a restaurant before that I just didn't like when they brought it to me and, you know, like when I looked at it on the menu, picked it out, understood what it cost. And then when they brought it to me, I was like, felt like betrayed by the restaurant, like in terms of then having to pay for something that I was going to thoroughly not enjoy. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess if it was like my fault and I ordered the wrong thing or something,
right.
I definitely have been in that situation too, like where, you know, maybe I thought I ordered one thing or I thought I was ordering one thing, but ordered something different. And, you know, in that situation, I'll just be like, oh, okay, well, you know, whatever, my mistake. And maybe this will be good anyways or whatever. But, you know, if, you know, like, I don't know, if I've ordered a cheeseburger and it comes out and the burger is inedible and there's no cheese on it, I will send it back.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to pay for food that I'm not going to eat or enjoy eating in the least. Like, and if, you know, like I usually also like try to be gentle and accommodating, even in that situation where I'm sending food back, but like I'll express to the server or whatever, what I think is wrong with it. And, you know, say that I'm open to, you know, whatever solution they're willing to provide, if they want to like remake it, or if they just want to try and fix it, or if they want to offer me something else, like,
right. You know,
but I wouldn't expect a customer to come to my restaurant and order something and be disgusted by it or be completely unsatisfied by it and still pay for that experience. Like,
right.
I would never expect that of a customer coming to my restaurant. And I don't really think that it's fair of a restaurant to expect that of me.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I guess so like, can we draw any conclusions from this discussion that we've had? Is food snobbery just the act of like being oblivious to the concerns of the people around you and voicing your opinion when it's unwarranted? Is that what makes a food snob?
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's also like when I think of like some of the chefs and authors that I most enjoy, they have like, I don't know, this gets kicked around a lot, like a broad appreciation of food. And by that, I mean, they recognize, like, they can appreciate home cooking. They can appreciate gas station convenience stores for what they are. They can appreciate haute cuisine. And I'm thinking of, like, I think the best, like, the guys who are that to a T would be the owners of Joe Beef, Fred Morin, and Dave McMillan, where you read through their books and they're making, like, you know, pepperoni sticks on the one hand, but also like oysters Rockefeller on the other. Like, they just, that's what I mean by broad appreciation, and like are just so humble, generous. And like, it doesn't matter whether they're serving French, like, or like what a fancy Burgundies or Pabst or whatever, like they love it and for what it is. And I think a lot of, especially like younger chefs, get these kind of weird blinders on where they think that the way to differentiate themselves is to shun or scoff at lower brow stuff or more common stuff, to the point that like they ruin a lot of what could be really enjoyable dining experiences.
Right. For themselves or for other people that they happen to be dining with. Or
yeah.
Makes sense to me, Alan.
Okay. Let it be. Write it down there.
Yeah, write that one down.
We solved it.
Put that, yeah. When we just, I'll mark the timestamp for this so that when we have to go through and make our book full of quotables, right, we'll have this one ready to go. Okay. Do you want to introduce your topic?
Yeah. So I was interested in the idea of a lot of the chefs I've worked with and for, they have a notebook, a little black book that they carry to work with them every day. And they've had for the last 10, 15, 20, whatever years, where they write all of their recipes and ideas and just little like tips on technique and things like that. And they're always fascinating when you get doesn't happen very often, but you get the chance to flip through them, what is written down. But I know it was interesting to me. I wanted to talk to you about it, especially because I don't think that you have an actual physical book, because you're a technological guy, but you must have something like that, a digital version of that, I would think. But I was interested to know what kind of stuff you record, how you record it, how these things are organized. Maybe I assume some of it you would never share, and that's actually a kind of like tangent to this, is like the idea of secret recipes and like withholding information from other people.
Yeah. I think that's actually a really good topic for a different day.
Oh yeah.
Like that. I think that's a topic on its own for sure. Like the secretiveness or whatever.
Like these books, I was always aware of them, but I didn't start really becoming fascinated by them and thinking about them a lot until there was a pretty well-known Edmonton chef who posted on social media in the last couple of years.
Oh my God, this is horrible. We have the same anecdote.
Oh, really? Is that true?
Yeah. Go on. Yeah,
is
go
it Lex?
On. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That he lost his book.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, and I don't remember the details of how it happened, but this was like something like a decade's worth of recipes and notes and experience.
Yeah. From restaurants all over the place where he had worked and collected like these little ideas. I think actually, like, I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly, that some of his stuff was stolen and his book was among the things that were stolen.
Is that right?
Like,
yeah.
Like his bag was stolen or something and his book was in there, and yeah, he was like heartbroken.
Yeah. But it was so interesting to me. Like, obviously that's going to be hard to deal with. But I would say, like, a talent like his, he already knows everything that's in that book, and he's probably forgotten more. This is a cliche. He's forgotten more about cooking than most people ever learn. But also, just like, yeah, is it silly to trust something like a physical book that you carry with you every day to contain those, to protect those little gems of knowledge? I don't know. It was,
yeah. Well, that's interesting. I think, like, I mean, I would like you said before, like, I don't actually have a book. I store all of my stuff electronically, and I have backups of my backups. You know, like, that's just kind of the kind of, like,
you're such a snob.
that's just how I'm living my 21st century existence.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, it's like much easier and like lower like cognitive barrier to like have a physical book or keep physical notes. Mm-hmm. And I definitely feel like everyone should, you know, do what, you know, is most effective for them. You know, and I'm sure that's probably, you know, why Lex kept that book, is because, you know, that was the best way for him to catalog that kind of stuff and, you know, mm-hmm. and have it at hand when he needed it and be able to find it and that kind of stuff, which makes it, like, you know, a terrible loss when, you know, because it's a physical object, and then once it's gone, it's just gone. And like you said, like, I'm sure he can, like, recover a lot. Like, probably a lot of things in that book are just, like, inherent to how he cooks now, right? You know, like,
yeah, for sure.
He probably knows a lot of the things that were in that book, like the back of his hand. But it's sort of like, you know, losing your security blanket. Like, what if you forget how you prepared this one thing, and then you don't have the resource to go back and figure it out or whatever? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so, like, the anecdote that I was going to tell to, like, elucidate your topic idea, mm-hmm. Was that when Lex lost his book, like, he reached out to Edmonton Chefs on social media, I think partially to just maybe see if it's possible that anyone found the book or something, you know? Because he knows a lot of people, or, mm-hmm. But then also, like, he asked people to, you know, provide him with something, like, from their book.
Yeah.
That might allow him to sort of, like, start a new one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was, like, really feeling for him. And so, like, we met up for lunch one day, and I brought like my resources with me, mm-hmm. so that I could, like, you know, hand some things off to him. And it was like through the course of that lunch that I realized that I actually don't really have a black book like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, even like, not the physical, you just mean like that store of recipes, yeah. And
yeah. So, like, I have a lot of recipes that I've developed or that I've gotten from other people or that I've found on the internet. Mm-hmm. I'll just, like, tell you the story about my lunch with Lex, and then maybe that will help, like, help you understand what I'm trying to get at. But, like, okay, so we went for lunch, and we were chatting about his book, and I think I had brought my computer with me. I think I brought my laptop with me because I store all of my recipes and notes and stuff about cooking in an app, mm-hmm. like in a note-taking app. So, like, at one point, you know, like, we're eating and we're talking about his book, and I, like, pulled out my computer and I was like, well, you know, like, I'd love to, like, you know, give you, you know, a bunch of recipes or, you know, like, whatever you need. So, like, what types of things are you looking for? Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, and he said basically what sort of, like, what you just said was, you know, like, in terms of, like, you know, he remembers most of what's in the book anyways, you know,
right.
Like,
yeah.
He's not really, like, some of it is just, like, ingrained in him and some of it is lost forever, but he's not necessarily, like, looking to replace that, you know, he's not looking to, like, go back and rebuild that. Mm-hmm. He's looking to start something new, and he's just, you know, in, like, I think, a community-minded way, like looking to reach out to like his fellow chefs in Edmonton to like get some inspiration for, you know, like to kick that off. And so he was like, you know, so I I'm not looking for anything specific. I'm just, you know, like if you have something that's like a special, you know, a special recipe to you or a special piece of knowledge, you know, that, that is important to you that like you kind of keep in your book, like, you know, that's the kind of thing that I would be looking for. And then I was like, actually, I don't really feel that kind of connection to a lot of the like recipes and information and stuff that I store, like from, you know, like previous places that I've worked in and stuff like that. I was like digging through my brain to like come up with something like kind of on the spot so that I could, you know, offer him something.
Right.
And I couldn't really think of anything off the top of my head. And then I was like, well, like, you know, I'll go through like all my resources and I'll pick out something special and I'll send it to you. Mm-hmm. And then like, I did that later on and I was like going through all my recipes and I was like, I don't know what to like. I don't that like the only thing that I could really come up with that's like sort of sacred to me in some weird way is like my mom's banana bread recipe.
Okay. I have that recipe.
Right. Like I've used it in several places.
Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and I guess I could have sent him that. But yeah, it's sort of like after having that interaction with him and like kind of, you know, talking to him about it and kind of like understanding what the, like what that book was for him. Mm-hmm. It sort of like made me look at my own like collection of recipes and resources as like more clinical than like, you know, anything that's like foundation of myself as a chef or something right. like that, you know?
But like, so, and to me, like those books aren't necessarily just recipes. There's a lot of recipes, mm-hmm. but there would be a lot of just like technique that like, I'm thinking, say like your time at Noma, don't you have mm-hmm. notes of like, just like, oh man, they prepare this way and they apply this to that. And do you have notes like that?
There's no time to make notes when you have to pick 45 grams of individual thyme leaves in like an hour and then like prepare a staff meal. For like, Noma was a crazy situation. And like, I don't really have notes from Noma, but I mean, I have a lot of internalized like experiences and memories from Noma and a lot right. of photographs. I took a lot of photos while I was there when I had the opportunity. I like brought my actual like DSLR camera to work with me like every day in my backpack, just in case there was an opportunity between services for me to like pull out my camera and take a few pictures of like food or cooks or whatever. So I have a lot of photos. But also when I was in Copenhagen, I worked in a restaurant called Fiskebar, and you know, when I was at Noma, I was only there for a short period of time and I was kind of moving around between stations. And so I was using like the information that they had on hand. Like I think maybe I made a few small notes, but like really I was just using like the recipes that they were handing me and just doing whatever the station chefs were asking me to do and not really just trying to work as hard as I could and not really thinking about too much else. Mm-hmm. But when I worked at Fiskebar, I worked there for 10 months and I, after a couple of months, you know, wound up being a station chef there and then working my way through pretty much each of the stations in the restaurant. And I did keep pretty, pretty extensive notes about the station setups and, you know, like my own personal sort of like checklist to make sure that I had everything to set up the station correctly and the order in which I had to prep things and sort of like some lists of priorities for doing prep to make sure that the station would be set for the day or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I do still actually have that book. I had like a little Moleskine notebook that I kept in my back pocket like the whole time that I worked there. And I have like quite a few notes in it.
Yeah.
And I have a folded up... I have a folded up prep list from there that's all in Danish, which like Danish is like a difficult language to learn. Mm-hmm. And the only portion of it that I learned was like the names of foods.
Right. No verbs.
So I can like, I can look at that prep list and I can pretty much read the whole thing. But like I can't read or understand anything else in Danish.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
That's what my experience in Austria, I just worked for 2 months in Austria, when I was in culinary school. And I took a German language class before I went there. But when I was there, the only thing I only knew the names of food ingredients, and they just had to like, they would just talk to me like a dog. Like they would just be like, yeah. Like the what, however simple they could make the instructions. And all I could say was the name of ingredients. And I could ask like, speak slower. What's that in English? Is this okay? And that was it. Like,
yeah. Luckily for me in Denmark, pretty much all Danish people speak English as well as you or I do, mm-hmm. Like with an accent, but you know, they all speak really good English.
Right. Yep.
So, or like a vast majority of them. Mm. On top of that, because Noma is in Copenhagen and because the Danish restaurant scene like really blew up like a decade ago, or, you know, there were tons and tons of international chefs coming to Copenhagen to work in restaurants there.
Right.
And so a lot of the kitchens were pretty used to, and, you know, there were, chefs from all over the place, but kind of the common language for the most part was English. Mm-hmm. And so most of the chefs, regardless of where they came from, you know, like at least had pretty reasonably good English.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, like that sort of like trickles down from Noma into a lot of the other restaurants in Copenhagen. Mm. If they're sort of like in the same scene and in the same like pool of chefs, then, you know, usually the people that are working there, a lot of the work gets done in English. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely at Fiskebar, it was more Danish than it was when I was at Noma. Like all the cooks there were, or like, let's say like 80% of the cooks were Danes. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, while we were prepping and during service and stuff, they all spoke to each other in Danish. Mm-hmm. And they called like the calls for like, food preparation, like whoever was calling the bills was calling them in Danish. And I had to learn the Danish names of all the dishes and stuff like that. But
so what about the other component of those books is like, and this is more, I know that some chefs will like be secretive about recipes, but I think the real, and especially you, Shale, I think what you might be most secret about is like your ideas. Do you know what I mean? Like your ideas for either a dish or like ideas for a service or a restaurant. Surely mm-hmm. you have some of those written down somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. So
you can say no if you want.
First of all, right off the bat, my thinking about ideas, about food ideas, maybe a little less so about business ideas, but I don't really have a ton of business ideas and I don't really like think about them that often. I don't flesh them out that much. Like,
okay.
Owning my own business has never really been at the top of my list of things that I really want to do. Mm-hmm.
But ideas for dishes and services, like you've done some really interesting pop-ups and stuff like that in the past. So you must have written those down before they happened, right? Or no?
Right. So my feeling about food ideas in general is that like I almost wish people would steal ideas from me. I guess I feel like ideas themselves individually are like once you've thought of the idea, it's basically already public.
Whoa. That's some like
I know that seems a little weird, but like I think that it's very rare to have like a truly original idea.
Yes. Like, yeah, for sure.
I usually think that if I've come up with an idea, definitely someone else has also come up with that same idea mm-hmm. and probably executed it, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like anti-protective of my secrets.
Okay.
I think that everyone should share all their secrets. And I think it's really weird when people are secretive about the way that they prepare food or recipes or, you know, like ideas that they've come up with for dishes or ideas that they've come up with for pop-ups. Like I'm like anti-secretive about that stuff mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. the most part. I think, I don't know, like you might be able to, point to something that like shows that maybe that's not entirely true, but like, kind of how I feel about it is that, like, if your idea is so sacred, if you had an idea, there's another idea where that idea came from.
Yeah.
And if you're worried that you're going to run out of ideas,
then you're not very creative.
Well, no, like, I just think that, like, you know, most people are creative enough to come up with, like, plenty of ideas. It's just that, you know, like, I think for a lot of people, maybe, and I think I probably felt this way, like closer to the beginning of my career, that like when you come up with an idea, it sort of is like a little like, yeah, like you do worry that you're not going to come up with another good idea
right.
or something.
Yep. Yep.
But I think like through working in like an aspect of the industry where like not only do I get to come up with ideas, but in a lot of circumstances I have to come up with a specific number of ideas on a specific time frame,
right.
like yeah, and you know, like having to do that has like taken the fear out of me of like not being able to come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, like mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure sometimes I probably still get writer's block when I'm trying to come up with food ideas for menus or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think like the thing that's like difficult about ideas is like coming up with like a structured way to give yourself the time to actually think about things and to actually, you know, ruminate on what you might want to do. And like,
right.
You know, like I think that once you sort of like develop a set of tools to give yourself the time to come up with ideas, then you don't really need to worry anymore about whether someone stole your idea, because if they did, like, hopefully it really works out for them. And hopefully they make a bunch of people happy serving that dish or whatever it happens mm-hmm. to be. Mm-hmm. And then you can just come up with another idea that hopefully is just as good.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how I feel about it. Like, I feel like if you're protective of your ideas, it just feels like, I don't know, feels a little bit like insecure to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, for me, like I do not consider, well, some of the like more concept ideas for business or whatever, those actually, sorry, if I can take a step back. So my black book, like I do have a black book, but my real black book is a blog, is buttonsoup.ca. Oh, right, yeah. So anything that I find interesting or that I want to be able to resource or sorry, to like look at later, I just post and like, I can see it whenever I want, and I'm not worried about keeping it a secret.
Right.
And for me, the main thing is like, you can, you know, you can have all of the recipes from the French Laundry and Noma and anywhere else in the world, they'll give them to you.
Yeah.
Right. That doesn't mean that you can, make those restaurants. Like
no.
having the recipes and operating those restaurants are just like two completely different things. Like the amount of work and expertise that is not contained in a recipe. Yeah. So like I'm not protective of that kind of information at all either.
Right. Yeah. And I think like that's a really good or like a really poignant demonstration of that is that like, you know, if your log is, you know, posted online, if your like store of information is posted for everyone to see, like
right.
that's, you know, that's kind of exactly how I feel about it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, though, in my case, I'm also kind of a recipe hoarder.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like, so in my, like, note-taking app where I do store recipes, I have, like, recipes for everything that I've prepared in the last, like, 10 years and, like, menus and tons of recipes that I just like clipped off websites. And so I really have to, when I need to go back and look through it to actually find something that's useful, mm-hmm. I really have to get good at like using the search tools in my...
My actual like physical black book is more like, there's not very many recipes in there unless they're like in the process of being refined. Once they're in a use, like a place where I would use them, I just post them.
Right.
So most of the stuff in that I actually write down and keep rather private is like, one of my favorite things to do, and I have less and less time to do it as years go on, but like just like writing fantasy menus, kind of like,
oh, yeah.
I'll have for me, there always needs to be some kind of like, I don't know. I'm not a really like free range creative. Like I need a topic. I need like a kernel. I need an inspiration. Like I need a theme basically. But I love to just like pick a theme, like whatever it is. Say like I had said, I had Greek takeaway tonight. Like mm-hmm. what would it be like if I wrote a Greek food menu? And so like I have drafts of Greek, like taverna, like oozeria menus in this book.
Totally.
And like, it's not a realistic, like I doubt that I'll have an opportunity to ever execute them in a professional setting. But I have like loads of them, like British pub, like what would my British pub menu look like? That kind of thing.
Oh my God, Alan, that's like another amazing topic for another day.
Yeah. I'll write it down.
Yeah. I guess we're kind of getting off on a tangent here now, but I have like a hilarious example for a fantasy menu. Mm-hmm. My sister really likes cheesecake, and so I was developing like an all cheesecake menu.
Yeah. Yep.
Like appetizer, like soup, main course, dessert, palate cleanser, like yeah.
That's funny.
Maybe I can share, like I never really completed it, yeah. But maybe I can like resurrect it and complete it for our fantasy menus episode.
That's one of the first ever, this is ridiculous. I haven't thought about this in a very long time. I didn't really cook much before I met my partner, Lisa. Mm-hmm. But one of the first, I can't remember if it's her birthday or an anniversary or something. I like made it, typed a menu and cooked her supper, and it was all cakes. So it was like, we had bean cakes and then fish cakes and then chocolate cake or something like that.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Weird. I probably have that printed out somewhere. I don't know where though.
All right. Well, if when we do the fantasy menus episode, you might have to resurrect it for our show notes. We can put a link. Maybe not. Is it posted? Oh, it's that was probably pre-blog, right?
Yeah. It would never. And even if it would never be posted.
Yeah. Cool. Well, do you feel like I somewhat answered your, or like got to the heart of your curiosity about my black book situation?
Yeah, and actually I was surprised. Well, actually, I don't know, you were a little bit evasive almost, because you said on the one hand you
hoard, let's get back to the heart of it
though. you hoard recipes,
right? I guess what I mean is like, and I think this is maybe part of the reason why I don't really feel like I have a super personal connection to my like collection of recipes and information, mm-hmm. is that like I just sort of pile everything in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So like I have a lot that I keep, but it's sort of like, here's a modern problem that we can all relate to.
Too much information.
Yeah. Everyone now, because you know, most people have smartphones, people take a ton of pictures. Mm-hmm. Not everyone takes like, but like parents, for instance, you know, like they always have a camera with them. Mm-hmm. Their kid's always eating a grape or something. And so
kids these days,
there's always an opportunity to take photos of your kids. And then after a few years, you wind up with like 38,000 photos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when you go back to like look through that store of photos, I mean, some people are probably really good at like, you know, at the end of every month or something, going through and like starring some photos or like posting, you know, like posting certain ones on Facebook or something, so that, you know, the ones that they like, so that they can like go back and right. have some sort of like kind of distilled down reference for the things that they actually
yep.
value.
Yep. I'm sure very few do that.
Right. Yeah. And it's a hard thing to do. And it's a hard thing to have the discipline to do. And like, I kind of feel like my recipe collection, or my collection of like techniques and recipes and stuff, is sort of like that. It's like a collection of like 200,000 photographs. And like, I don't have any way of like, at least with the photo thing, it's starting to get to the point where you have like good tools to maybe like go back and go through and like, you know, but for me to like go back through that store of recipes, which I, you know, like I do from time to time, like, you know, every once in a while, I'll just like go back and look through some of my notes, or think about when I was working at a particular place and, or like think about a dish that I was making, on a certain menu, and like go back and like try to find it or recover it or something. And yeah, it's just like, there's so much information there, and there's so many recipes, and there's, you know, there's so much stuff that it's just like daunting to try and kind of like go through it and actually find the stuff that would be like, you know, that I would have a personal connection to, or, right. or that I do feel like is foundational for me or whatever.
Yeah.
It just, you know, like it's just more like this huge pile of information, and I don't really have a way of going in and like teasing out the things that I actually have a connection to.
Right. That's interesting. 'Cause to me, like that's the ultimate double-edged sword of the, cooking in the internet age, is that there's, doesn't matter what you're searching for, you'll find a million recipes for it.
Yeah.
But most of them are, well, a lot of them are identical. Most of them are garbage, right? Like, like you can't just pull a recipe for blood sausage off of Epicurious and expect it to be good, right? Like you need to yeah. find someone who knows about sausage making and stuff like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like, yeah. And that's sort of like, that's not just because of the quality of recipes, but it's also because of the information density that recipes can actually contain, you know,
right.
like,
yeah,
no matter how well you lay out a recipe, it's always going to be open to interpretation. And unless you kind of understand or have the skill to interpret that specific recipe for the context that it was built in, then it can be really hard to do it correctly.
That's true. That's certainly true. I think that that's a nuance. Whereas like I'm talking about with recipes on the internet, there's all of a sudden new like aggregate kind of sites will spring up, and it's like they just scraped the internet for one oh, recipe yeah. for everything, like that, like Spruce Eats or whatever. I can't remember what it's called.
Don't know. They just about like it.
Right. Most of the time, like it used to be, if you Google a recipe for something, like Epicurious would come up all the time. Mm-hmm. They would be one of the first returns. And now I find it's the Spruce Eats one. And it's seriously like they scrape the internet for one recipe of every preparation ever made, and it's just SEO. Everything is just like, it's right. a junky recipe with not very much heart or detail or anything like that. But they've dialed in the search engine optimization, and so like that's what you get now.
Right.
And so the black book, whether it's a blog or a book or whatever, is me filtering everything else out and latching on to the stuff that I've found. And it's not like most of it's original. Mm-hmm. Most of it is Alton Brown or Michael Rollman or whoever else.
Yeah,
but like,
of course.
I've latched onto it. And I know like, this is trustworthy. This is the, like, you can believe in this.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that yours is almost has an element of the internet scrape. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's exactly what it's like. It contains a lot of recipes that I've vetted and used like to prepare dishes in restaurants or whatever,
right?
But it's also just like full of stuff that I've scraped from the internet to use as like jumping off points to create a recipe for something else,
right? Yeah.
And so and then you know, like, I, because I have never, you know, bothered to go back and make notes about what I used, or like, you know, like I'll clip a recipe from the internet, and then I'll do, or like I'll clip five recipes from the internet mm-hmm. for a specific preparation, and then I'll look through them all and see where the commonalities are.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
And then I'll, in a lot of cases, you know, try to prepare something, and then, you know, like see which things are real and which things aren't in all of the recipes that I've looked at.
Right.
And then I'll, you know, create my own recipe out of that. But then all of those recipes that I used to do that research are just still in my archive.
Yeah.
And then if I were to go back, you know, like I might find the recipe that I created from them,
right.
but I also might just like find, you know, one of the five recipes that I used to teach myself how to make apple pie or something.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Know? Yeah. I understand. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Maybe, I guess I'm just hoping that eventually there'll be an artificial intelligence that's way smarter than I am that can mm-hmm. just look at my recipe archive and be like, these are the ones that you really want.
Well, by that time, humans won't even need to cook for themselves. So
it'll God be a moot point. Oh, speaking of which, I heard something interesting about lab-grown meat recently.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. There's actually going to be like a marketed lab-grown meat product. Where was that, though? Singapore? Can't remember. There's actually a company that's going to be producing lab-grown meat and selling it.
Huh.
Not in North America yet, but
mm-hmm.
I found that interesting.
I'd be interested to read more about that. I guess
I'd be interested to taste some lab-grown meat at some point.
They don't market lab-grown meat. They got to get someone in marketing.
Oh yeah, I'm not doing it justice. I'm sure they have a better marketing plan than. Oh, I think actually no. Maybe I can remember one of the names for it. Oh, this almost sounds worse. But one of the terms in the marketing material was kill-free meat.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I think that's better than lab-grown meat.
Yeah,
for sure.
Brave new world. Wow.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in your favorite podcast app. Check us out on the web at foodcourt.fm and follow us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to help spread the word, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'll be back with a fresh new episode in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.